You're listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks, your source for centered and focused play therapy coaching.
Hi, I'm Dr. Brenna Hicks, the kid counselor. This is the Play Therapy Podcast, where you get a masterclass in child-centered play therapy and practical support and application for your work with children and their families. In today's episode, I am continuing the summer school series, and in probably several weeks, we'll be wrapping this up because we'll be hitting September soon. But in the meantime, I'm going to continue to read sections from seminal works in the child-centered space. And today I'm reading out of Play Therapy, Art of the Relationship, 4th edition by Gary Landreth. And by the way, I wanted to let y'all know, some of you have reached out and said that this summer school series has been so helpful to you and so impactful. Many of you said you're actually buying the books and starting to read them now. And I'm so encouraged by that. That is actually the reason why that I did this. It was my hope that it would inspire you to, if you're going to want to be a child-centered play therapist at the highest level, to recognize that we have to go back to the basics and the beginning and not let dilutions and changes and evolutions in the field become our focus. We have to go back to the beginning and look at the groundwork that was laid. And that comes from these texts that were written in the 80s and 90s. So I'm so happy to hear that many of you have started buying the books and started reading them and that this has been helpful for you as a summer school series. So thanks for the feedback. I always like to hear if what we're doing is working and helpful. And so if you ever want to reach out, share your thoughts with me, ask questions, have me answer one of your questions on an episode, you can reach me at brenna@thekidcounselor.com. By the way, if you're new to the podcast, so glad you're here. I know every single day someone else finds the podcast. So welcome if you are new. Really, really happy you found us. Happy that you are interested in child-centered play therapy and happy that you are trying to become a better clinician. If this is your first episode or one of your first few, please know that the Summer School series is a standalone series. And historically, we have gone through curriculum in chronological need order. So what I mean by that is you need to go back and start at episode one and listen in order to really benefit from the content of the podcast. And if you have been around with me forever, I know there are those of you out there that have listened to every episode, actually several times, some of you. And I know there are those of you that have never missed one episode. So we have everyone in between. So fresh to the podcast, those that have been with me from the beginning and that have heard everyone. And really, I can't tell you how much I appreciate each and every one of you, how grateful I am for you. You really, truly add a lovely element to my week when I get to sit down and do a podcast episode. So grateful for you. Thanks for listening. All right. So let's dive into this. I'm actually reading 3 sections of the same section. Does that make any sense? So I'm in the first chapter and I'm on pages 9, 10, and 11. But I'm not reading it straight through. So this section, I'm actually going to go through several different sections of a section. I don't know if that makes any sense. But anyway, pages 9, 10, and 11, that's all you need to know if you need to find it. Okay, so let's start with the first one. And let me kind of set the stage a little bit. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm telling you a lie. It's actually the start of chapter 2 that I'm reading from. So I'm sorry. It was chapter 2, The Meaning of Play. And this is kind of giving backstory on why children need to play and why we provide play therapy for kids. So that's the backstory of what is leading to these particular passages that I'm going to read. Okay, so from chapter 9, play is a medium of exchange, and restricting children to verbal expression automatically places a barrier to a therapeutic relationship by imposing limitations that in effect say to children, you must come up to my level of communication and communicate with words. All right, I'm going to read that again because that's a long sentence and I want to tease apart some of those different portions. Play is a medium of exchange. We know that. It's a way that children communicate, right? And restricting children to verbal expression, I'm going to add in Brenna's parenthetical reference, or cognitive activities, close parenthesis. Restricting children to verbal expression or cognitive activities automatically places a barrier to a therapeutic relationship. For those of you converts, those of you that used to be directive, those of you that used to be eclectic, those of you who used to do worksheets and activities and have kids talk about why they hit their friends at school and have them do a feelings faces activity, did you ever feel that there was a barrier to the therapeutic relationship when you were doing that with kids? I know you do. You've told me that that was the case, and that's why you switched. It imposes limitations that, in effect, say to children, quote, you must come up to my level of communication and communicate with words. Brenna's parenthetical reference, or you must come up to my level of cognition and interact cognitively through this worksheet, through this discussion, through whatever. Okay. The therapist's responsibility is to go to the child's level and communicate with children through the medium with which they are comfortable. Why must the child accommodate the adult? Wow, let that sink in for a second. Why must the child accommodate the adult? And then to add insult to injury, let's rub salt in the wound. The therapist is the one who is supposed to be well-adjusted, to have developed coping skills, to know how to communicate effectively at all levels, and to possess a developmental understanding of children. So why must the child accommodate the adult? Wow. If that doesn't make you feel guilty for any time in your entire career that you did not go down to a child's level and wanted them to come up to yours. Continuing, when the therapist says, tell me about it, end quote, young children are placed at a disadvantage of having to accommodate the therapist and not the other way around. So therein lies the justification for why we play, for why we don't lead, for why we don't direct, for why we don't bring topics up, why we don't intervene, why we don't interfere, why we don't bring up topics of discussion, why we don't guide what the child should play with, when or why. Because we are not giving kids the advantage when we expect them to come up to our level, which is cognitive and verbal. So when we expect a child to talk to us or to think through something, we're putting them at a disadvantage and we are supposed to be accommodating them. Okay, so let me continue. I'm going to skip some of the text, but I'm going to continue in the same section of the text. So on page 10, feelings and attitudes that may be too threatening for the child to express directly can be safely projected through self-chosen toys. Instead of verbalizing thoughts and feelings, a child may bury in the sand, shoot the dragon, or spank the doll representing baby brother. So let's think about this. We understand kids aren't verbal. We understand they're not cognitive. They don't have abstract reasoning. They are not able to function at our level. So often that means that they have feelings and/or attitudes that would be very threatening for them to address directly, to express directly. But they can safely project that through the toys that they choose to use. And then there's examples provided for you. A child can bury something in the sand, shoot the dragon, or spank the doll representing baby brother. They're not going to really understand what is happening, but they know that they need a release of it. So that is really helpful to understand that when they're able to play something out, it is the way that they're projecting things that they don't know any other way to express. Okay, and then I'm going to skip a little bit further. Bottom of 10, top of 11. This is actually a quote from Bettelheim from 1987. And I'm actually going to give you that specific reference because I want you to be able to look that up if you choose. That is an article that was published in Atlantic Monthly called The Importance of Play. And that was Bettelheim in 1987 in Atlantic Monthly. So this is a complete quote from Bettelheim on page 40 in the original text on page 10 and 11 in Art of the Relationship. Here's the quote. The most normal and competent child encounters what seem like insurmountable problems in living. The most normal and competent child, meaning best case scenario, encounters what seem like insurmountable problems in living. The world is scary. The world is unpredictable. The world is overwhelming. The world is unknown. The world is confusing. The world is big. It creates problems that seem insurmountable to kids, even in the best circumstances. Continuing, but by playing them out in the way she chooses, she may become able to cope with them in a step-by-step process. She often does so in symbolic ways that are hard for her to even understand, as she is reacting to inner processes whose origin may be buried deep in her unconscious. Okay, let me pause there. That's the heart of why we do what we do. The world has insurmountable problems that seem too much to handle, but if a child plays them out in her way, she becomes able to cope with them in a step-by-step process. There's a desensitization. There's an increase in competence. There's a better sense of self. There's trust of self. There's coping skills that are built, problem-solving skills that are acquired, right? So step-by-step, child becomes able to cope with these things in symbolic ways that sometimes the child will not even understand, nor will we, because the child is reacting to inner processes whose origin may be buried deep in the unconscious. Sometimes the child doesn't know, and sometimes we don't know, but it doesn't mean it doesn't work. Okay, continuing, this may result in play that makes little sense to adults at the moment, or may even seem ill-advised, since we do not know the purpose it serves or how it will end. But when there is no immediate danger, it is usually best to approve of the child's play without interfering, just because he is so engrossed in it. All right, let me pause there. So Bettelheim is even acknowledging that sometimes we watch a child's play and it makes little sense to us. And or sometimes we don't think that it's something that a child should do. Sometimes it seems ill-advised because we don't know the purpose or how it will end. What outcome may come from this? What's the purpose of this? Why is the child doing this? Have you ever found yourself questioning what's going on in the playroom? However, Bettelheim says, when there is no immediate danger, i.e., we have three questions that we ask about limits. Am I safe? Is the child safe? Is something going to get damaged or broken? If the answer is no, then there is no immediate danger. It is usually best to approve of the child's play without interfering, just because he is so engrossed in it. Now listen to this. Efforts to assist him in his struggles, while well-intentioned, may divert him from seeking and eventually finding the solution that will serve him best. How many times do we have to sit on our hands? How many times do we have to stop ourselves from interfering or assisting or helping or solving or lessening the blow of something, taking the hurt away, rescuing them from the pain? That's the nature of an adult with a child, and that's the nature of a helper to someone that needs help. But here's what that does. If we make an effort to assist, even with good intentions, which they always are, it can divert him from seeking and eventually finding the solution that will serve him best. What does that speak of? The child-centered self-actualization process. He knows that it's a problem. He knows he needs to solve it. He knows that he will seek until he finds what's going to work. And anything we do is only going to get in the way and divert him and be a hindrance. That's child-centeredness. That's non-directive. That's the child leading the play session. Why? Because the child knows. We just let the child do what the child needs to do. His pace, his way, his time. The environment of the playroom, the relationship with the clinician. The child is able to find the solution that serves him best. So we don't need to assist him. We don't need to do anything. Even when something doesn't make sense, even when it seems ill-advised, even when we're watching it and we're confused as to what this could possibly mean for the child, we just stay out of the way and we let the child do their work. So let's weave the three of these things together as we close. So by not letting a child just play, by expecting a child to verbalize things or to process things cognitively or do some kind of activity, we are actually placing them at a disadvantage, forcing them to accommodate us, and we are imposing limitations on the therapeutic relationship with barriers. Okay, so that's point number one. So if we understand that, I no longer want to be a barrier or impose limitations or put a child at a disadvantage. So I'm going to wholly be child-centered so that they can communicate through their play. Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two, children will then naturally, if allowed to just play and not have to verbalize or cognitively process things, they will project through their toys the feelings and attitudes that are too threatening for them to express directly. So that is a means to an end for them. They come in and play what they can't communicate in any other capacity. And then finally, the world is hard and life is tricky and kids are going to play them out so that they can step by step build coping skills. And that's done in symbolic ways that we don't always understand. But if we don't get in the way, they will seek and find the solution that serves them best. And when a child seeks and finds a solution, notice the ownership and the pride and the long-term effect that has versus something that we might have led them to, talk to them about, forced them to think about. That's a temporary, very, very surface level solution. Whereas a child wrestles with it and fights with it and struggles with it and comes up with it on their own, now all of a sudden, long-term results because the child figured it out and the child will still continue to possess the capacity to figure that out in the future because they've proven that they're capable. All right, y'all, I hope that encourages you. This is such a fantastic book. I just, every time I read it, I find little golden nuggets. And I think that it's just such a helpful reminder when we dive into this stuff of why we're doing what we're doing and kind of that spur to continue to do this when sometimes it's not easy and sometimes we don't really feel adequately equipped and we're not really sure if it's worth the fight and the struggle and the supervisors not being on board and colleagues not understanding what we're doing. And is this really working? Because parents really don't seem like they see any value in this and I'm constantly defending myself and no one understands what I do. We're all in the same boat, y'all. That's what you take on when you take on being a child-centered play therapist. But these works and these texts remind us that it's worth it. And they ground us again so that we can continue to fight the good fight. So, love y'all so much. Thanks for spending time with me each week. We'll talk again soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks. For more episodes and resources, please go to www.playtherapypodcast.com.